Well, one of the things we do in a church membership class is we have you to write out your story, and I just enjoy reading your stories, and everyone's story is so unique. There's no two stories quite alike about how God has worked in your life to bring you to become a follower of Christ. Some are very dramatic, not too many, but some are like kind of like the Apostle Paul. Was his a dramatic story? Going on the road to Damascus, and God speaks to him. He's struck down blind, and what a dramatic story of life change in his life. Kind of like, have you read the book Unbroken about the life of Louis Zamperini out on the ocean, shot down by the enemy, and was out there 47 days on the sea? And how God dealt with him, and what a story. It's a gripping story. So I don't have a story like that. I'm not like the Apostle Paul. I'm more like, and maybe you're more like, Paul's son in the ministry, Timothy. Timothy, the scripture says, he was raised by his mother and grandmother. We'd say he's raised in a Christian home. Here's what I find in many stories that you write is that the very first line you say, I was raised in a Christian home. So that would be a lot of your stories. It's not a dramatic one. That would be my story too. I was raised in a Christian home. But here's how God worked in my life. Then some of you may be like the Apostle Peter. Your story was... His story was he faltered, he failed, he flourished, he faltered, he flailed, he flourished, he just up and down, up and down. Maybe that's you. Maybe that's kind of how your story has been. You know, I did pretty well, but then I failed and I just did miserable and all this, and I ended up in the pit, and now I'm doing good. And all and so I don't know what your story is, but everybody has a unique story. In fact, I'm hoping in the near future that we can take some of your stories and just have you to come here and read us your story. They're inspirational about how God, in so much of a unique way, takes our story to glorify Him. Now, today's scripture, chapter 2, is primarily Jonah's story. If Jonah was here, he would say, "This is my story," and he would read chapter 2. And there's a lot of lessons in this story. Now, behind this story, chapter 1 is all what led up to this. If you look in verse 1 of chapter 1, it says, "The word of the Lord came to Jonah." And what did he do with that? He ignored it. Not only did he ignore it, he rebelled against it. He ran. And the consequences of that were severe. And then it starts in chapter 2. And I like the way, look at the way that chapter 2 starts. The very first word is what?
Then.
He ends up in the belly of the fish. Then, what does he do? Then he prayed. So here's the first insight I think that we can get from his story. Is that then he prayed. Then he prayed. So here's the principle that we understand here. He prayed out of distress. God answered out of grace. Let me say that again. He prayed in or out. He prayed out of distress. God answered out of grace. Say that with me. He prayed out of distress. He answered, okay, he prayed out of distress, God answered out of grace. That's the way God works, and that was his testimony, that was his story. I cried out to God, I was in the belly of the fish, I didn't think I'd make it. The storm had hit, and the storm was a result of his running from God. But I want you to notice one other thing. The storm not only hit his life, but who else? The storm hit the sailors. Did they ask for that? Did they call for that? Was it their fault? No. Some of you here today are suffering the consequences, and there's nobody to blame but you. Some of you here today are suffering the consequences because somebody else created the storm in your life. You didn't ask for it. You didn't call for it. But their storm has become your storm. Any of you experienced that? You didn't create the suffering you're going through right now, but it is there. And that's what happened in the sailors. That storm was dumped on them. But Jonah was ignoring God. In this call of his life, he was ignoring God. Any of you, I thought of thinking about that this week, about ignoring God. And I know how that a lot of times when I was a kid, I'd ignore Dad. In the morning time, I knew he'd said something yesterday that he had some things for me to do. I was hoping that he'd forget. And so what I'd do the first thing in the morning, I would get outside to play and ride my bike and take off and do whatever. And I think, maybe he'll forget. And maybe if I just stay away, I'll not hear him. You know, some people stay away from church because that's a good, safe place to not hear God. Or maybe you try to. I never did. I don't know if you ever did this or not. I never did go in early in the morning and say, "Hey, Dad, what do you want me to do today?" I never did do that. Did you? Did you ever have your kids come to you first thing in the morning and say, "Hey, Mom, hey, Dad, what do you want me to do today?" Now, what do you do? Do you ever do that with God? One of the great ways to start off a day is in your time alone, say, "God, what do you have in store? What do you want to do through my life today?" I've got a good friend that every morning, he said before he allows his feet to hit the floor, he slides out of bed and kneels beside the bed. "God, what do you have in store for my life? How can you use me?" That's the first thing he does. That's a good discipline. That's a good habit. Do you have a morning? Maybe you're not like Jonah. You're not rebelling and running. You're just simply ignoring God. You're not checking in to say, "God, what would you have me to do? What do you want to do through me in today?" We run toward comfort, not a calling. We'll run by nature. We'll run toward comfort, not the calling that God has on our life. And then we don't do anything about it, and then a little pain. And pain usually brings us, then Jonah prayed. Pain come. He was in the belly of the fish, you know, a storm had hit. And is pain good or bad? C.S. Lewis wrote a book on pain. I want to just see one thing he said about it. He said, "God whispers to us in our pleasure, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain." This is a line I like right here. "It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world." It's a megaphone. It's a megaphone. What would happen if you did not have pain? Two of our closest friends in seminary was Jim and Kay Akins. Right before they came to seminary, they had an automobile accident and left her paralyzed from the waist down, no feeling. And I remember one time that we'd usually go down to their house every evening for coffee or something, and she had had a hot pan of popcorn on her lap and burned her legs severely. She had no idea it was burning her legs. She had to be very careful because she would not know. She'd have all kinds of bruises and all that kind of. She had no idea because she cannot feel. Pain is good. Pain alerts us. It is a megaphone that we need. Jonah needed the pain. And so it goes on to verse 3 and 4. It says, "You cast me into the deep." This is painful. "You cast me into the deep, into the heart of the sea, and the flood surrounded me. All the waves and your billows passed over me. Then I said, I am driven from your side." Kind of like I'm done for. Then he made a decision. Yet I shall again look upon your holy temple. When it says, I'll look upon your holy temple, the holy temple is a place they thought that they saw that as a place that God resides. So in essence, he said, I turned to look to God. That's the result of pain. God will allow pain to come in our lives a lot of times to get our attention, the megaphone, to bring conviction in our life about the wrong. Pain is good. God's Spirit works in a way that we would call it conviction or pain. Now, we can ignore that and sometimes be numb to that. But it is a good thing. Philip Yancey wrote a book on pain, and he said, pain is God's gift no one wants. He calls it a gift. But none of us want that gift. But it says, you cast me. You know what it says? He didn't blame anybody else. I'm guilty. He said, you're the one that you cast me into this situation. And he made no excuses whatsoever. Kind of like King David when he realized his sin with Bathsheba. And he says, against you and you only have I sinned. A number of years ago, I read a Swiss psychologist and psychiatrist, Carl Jung. One phrase that stood out to me when I read what he said, the person that makes excuses is the only person I cannot help. And I think that is true. I'm not a counselor by any means. If you got a problem, I'm probably not the one to come to. But what I have found is that when I talk to people and they make excuses, I realized, and sometimes I just tell them, I said, there's no way I can help you. As long as you're making excuses for the mess you're in, well, it's my parents' fault. It's my neighbor's fault. It's my kid's fault. It's my employer's fault. As long as you're making excuses, as long as I make excuses, there's no help. We have to come to the place that we admit. That's kind of a repentant time. And that's what Jonah was doing. He said, I'm guilty. I'm guilty. That was the first step of turning his life around. Kind of like remember the story of the prodigal son? And he ends up totally broke, spent all the money. He had burned through all the good time he thought was a good time. And found himself, lo and behold, of all things, feeding pigs, which for the Jews was a disgrace. And he said, I will arise at the turning point. I will arise and go to my father. Maybe some of you are at the turning point and say, I will arise. I repent. I have done wrong. I can't blame anybody else. I will arise. Now, it's interesting, the prodigal son, he wasn't sure how his father would respond to him. He thought, maybe he would just let me come in and be a hard hand, and at least I'll have a roof over my head. But what did he find waiting for him? The Bible, I love the way this Bible says it. While he was at a far distance, his father saw him. Why do you think he saw him? He's always watching. He's always watching for his son to return. That's God's grace. See, he did not deserve that. He went home out of distress. His father answered out of grace. By the way, how should we respond to others that have fallen? You know, Jonah loved the idea of God's grace, but he didn't love the idea of being gracious to Nineveh. He wanted God's grace, but he didn't care anything about expressing that grace to Nineveh. He wanted them to be doomed. He didn't want them to experience God's love. So let me ask you. You love God's grace. You don't earn it or deserve it. You repent. and His grace is always there. But the question is, do any of you have any kids that have rebelled? They're a mess. Any of you have parents? They're a mess. Any of you work for somebody? They're a mess. You know, it's interesting. How do we usually treat Christians that fall? Somebody told me, said, you know, Christians are the only one that shoot their own wounded. Sometimes that's true. We love God's grace, but you mess up and we'll shoot you. Not with a bullet, but you know, we can say all kinds of things. You know, so how do you become a dispenser of God's grace like He dispenses His grace to you? That was the challenge for Jonah. He wanted the grace of God in his life, but he didn't want to go to Nineveh to let them know the grace of God. And so he ran from that. The scriptures goes on in verse 5 and says, the water closed in over me, still telling about his story. The waters closed in over me to take my life. And the deep surrounded me. These weeds were wrapped around my head at the root of the mountain. What does that mean? That means as low as you can get. I went down into the land whose bars closed upon me forever. That's the way they saw death. Bars would close you from life and you were locked up into death forever. I went down to the land whose bars closed up around me. Yet, here's the turning point again. Yet you brought my life up from the what? Up from the pit. God's grace is good, reaching down in the pit. Now, one word in there that I spent some time on as I was looking at this is the word down. You know how many times it talks about his downward slope? He went down to Joppa, not Nineveh. He went down to Joppa. He's on the run. Then he went down to the boat. He went down into the bottom of the boat. Then he found himself down in the belly of the fish. Here's a life that is headed toward the pit big time. Down, 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 down. In despair, he hit bottom. And a lot of times, we only are willing to turn when we hit bottom. We found that, and the people in Alcohol Anonymous have taught us so very well, a great lesson. There's not a whole lot you can do for an alcoholic until they hit bottom. I've tried. Until they come to the place that they're hopeless and they realize I've hit bottom. It is then that God's grace can become a reality in their life because they have hit bottom. Let's go back to Louis Zamperini. He hit bottom. I love the story, and it's not in the movie, and I wish they had not left that out, but they did. But in the book, it's very, very explicit about that. You know, he was out in the sea for 47 days and then thought he was going to be rescued, but the plane that rescued them was the enemy plane, so he was taken to a concentration camp, and absolutely brutal, brutal. And many died in the concentration camp. You see some of the pictures, just absolutely horrible. But then he gets out and comes home. And he's not set free at all. He still finds himself in a prison because he wakes up every night with these nightmares that he sees all this all over again. And his wife got afraid of him because he'd come out of that nightmare striking at anything around him. So he used alcohol some way to bury himself, and he became a terrible alcoholic. His wife said, I cannot stand this any longer, and she left him. He continued to drink. She came home to work out the final agreements on the divorce. Billy Graham happened to be in town. And she asked him and then begged him to go with her to the crusade that night. He said, no, 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 no. She said, I'm going anyway, and she did. God got a hold of her life in such a marvelous way of grace. And when she experienced that grace, what do you think she did? That grace began to overflow from her to Louis. And he saw that. Something happened to my wife. She said, I want you to go to the crusade. No, no, no. She begged him until he was willing to go. But then he got to that part. If you've been to a Billy Graham crusade or seen him on television, this is the way he always ended. Every head bowed and every eye closed. Remember that? It's decision time. Every head bowed and every eye closed. And as soon as he said every head bowed and every eye closed, what do you think Louis did? He darted out of there like a bullet. So the next night she said, I want you to go with me again. He said, no, I went watching. I'm not going to go back. She kept persuading. He said, okay, I'm going, but I'm telling you, when they bow their head, I'm out of there. They got to the end of the service. Every head bowed, every eye closed. And sure enough, Louis begins to dart out. He gets down to the end of the aisle to leave. And some way God conquers his heart, and he finds himself headed straight to the front. And there he met the grace of God. He went home. This is a kind of Apostle Paul story. Not many would have a story like this. And he went home. He got all of the liquor in all the house and dumped it down the drain. He smoked one cigarette after another. He took all that and threw it in the trash. And here's what the grace of God did for him. It's a miraculous thing. It doesn't happen this way to everybody, but a miraculous thing. He said, I never had a nightmare thereafter. I had no desire for any alcohol thereafter. Totally healed by the grace of God. He went to God in distress. God answered in grace. That's the great thing about this grace of God. He goes on to say in verse 7 through 9, says, when my life was fainting away. He's telling his story now. I remember the Lord. I wonder what he remembered. He probably remembered that call for what he was supposed to. He remembered the Lord. And my prayer came to you. That's the grace. I came to you out of distress, and your grace answered me. And so I remember the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple. Those who pay regard. Now he's talking about the people that are not followers of God. Those who pay no regard. Those who pay regard to vain idols, they're not paying regard to God. They're paying regard to these vain idols, forsake their hope of the steadfast love. They do not know what the grace of God is. But I, there's two words I want you to notice in here. But I, with a voice of thanksgiving, will. I will. He's still talking about that turning point in his life. I will. And I got to thinking that I wonder what held him back from saying, I will. And then I got to think, what keeps me a lot of times from saying, I will? God kind of nudges at my heart. I know that I need to do some action. And why do I hold back from I will? Why do you hold back from I will? You know what it is to sense God tugging at your heart. Why is it that you do not immediately say, I will, I will, I will? I think here's some reasons. Let me give you four reasons. That Jonah did not say, I will immediately. And it's the same reason I do not say, I will immediately many times. Fear. What is he afraid of? He was afraid of Nineveh. The Bible calls it, I want you to go to the great city of Nineveh. That was the capital of the most notorious, strongest nation in the world, Assyria. They'd eat people up and spit them out worse than a big fish. And he thought it was impossible. God, You're calling me to something that is impossible. Besides, I don't even like them. But it's impossible. When I sensed that God first called me to the ministry, I said, you got to be kidding me. I would not say I will. I said, I can't. Now, has that been your response? Yeah, God kind of tugging you off? Maybe you've not responded to God and His grace. And you've not said, I will follow you. And maybe God's calling you to do something. You know that He wants you to serve in some way. He wants you to maybe go to a neighbor or a friend. And you say, no way, that's impossible. They're not going to respond. You know, research says that you'll be surprised, a large percentage of people, if you build any kind of relationship with them at all and invite them to come to church, they'll come. We had a couple last hour that was here. I said, how'd you know about our church? She said, I was getting my nails done. God will work in a nail shop too. And they talked about church. And where do you go? And they came. Somebody invited them. You'd be surprised how many people. Just the invitation. So it's a fear that they'd say no. It's a fear this is an impossible task. I can't do that. I think another reason why, this interesting one, is that when he went down to the boat, he bought a ticket with money. Now, what's unusual about that? Money was hardly a deal then. It was usually by barter. Money means options. He had, in other words, he didn't say, I will, because he saw other options. He was going to Joppa. That had been like going to Hawaii rather than the desert. And he had options. You know, when I began to sense God wanted me to do something, I would say, Lord, I will serve this way. I want to do it my way. I didn't want to preach. I wanted to sing, you know. So sometimes we will not say, I will, because that's not what we'd like to do. And he wants you to serve in a certain way and say, you know, I'll serve, but I don't want to do that. And it holds us back from saying, yeah. Another reason why I think that Jonas did not say, I will, immediately, because he felt so guilty. Failed. And sometimes we might come to the place, you know, I have botched up my life so much, I've messed up so much, there's no way God could use me. I've run into people like that, maybe you. But the biggest one, and mark this one down well, because I think this is a chief one, this is a key one, this is one that overarches everything else. Well, why did he not say, I will? Because he had no love whatsoever for Nineveh. He had no love. He didn't understand, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul, and your neighbor as yourself. And so it is that lack of love that doesn't move us to Nineveh to do anything. You know, are you familiar with Jeanette Penn? He's a comedian, but an atheist, and very vocal about being an atheist. Go and look at YouTube sometime. Just put in Jeanette Penn and see his story. After one of his shows, a man came to him, and he said, the guy was so pleasant. He said, I'd like to give you a Bible. And he said, I'm an atheist. I'm not interested in that. But the guy was so nice, I took the Bible. And I tell you the truth, I appreciated him thinking about me. And I took the Bible, and he went on his way. And then he said, you know, I respect what he did. I have a great respect because he came to me. I'm not a believer, but that didn't stop him. I've got a great respect. I don't have a whole lot of respect. If you really believe, this guy really believed that stuff, and he came to me. The part that will blow you off your feet that Jeanette Penn said, He said, how much do you have to hate somebody not to tell them that you really believe in a heaven and a hell? He said, this guy really believed that. How much do you have to hate somebody that you would not tell them that? He said, I have a great respect. This is an atheist. He said, I have a great respect because he's really nice. And gave me a Bible. So the question we have to deal with is, how much do we have to hate somebody to not go to Nineveh, where they are? You and I live in Nineveh. We've got a Nineveh to deal with. How much? There's one guy that very rarely, but some, comes to church. And I drive by every Sunday morning the street that takes me to his house. Most every Sunday, and I drive by, I pray for him. Every day I try to pray for people that I'm terribly concerned about. And I wonder how much I have to hate somebody not to allow fear to overcome me and tell them about the grace of God. There's somebody that loves you more than you can ever imagine. What is it that would stop me from saying I will? What is it? Fear? The lack of love? What is it? And to overcome that. So Jonah said, I will. I will. And verse 10, it's kind of gory, but he says, and the Lord spoke to the fish and vomited. When's the last time you saw vomit? He didn't come out of there a clean, clean kid. It says he had, had all this seaweed around him and leftover tuna that had not been quite digested yet. And all this stuff came out, and out on the bank he lands. And he looks around and looks at himself. I am a mess. And it took a while, I'm sure, for reality to kind of soak in. Hey, I am really alive. Kind of like one day I was going to the airport, and it was just a real thin, you could hardly see it, thin sheet of ice. And I went up on 435. And just as I got up there, my truck totally, and in snow you have a little bit of traction. You're absolutely helpless on a sheet of ice. No brakes, no steering, nothing works. It's all gone. Off over the embankment I go. Do you know how much goes through your mind in a few seconds? I thought, I am rolling. I just hunkered down, got ready to roll. Thank God for seat belts. And I could just see myself rolling. And lo and behold, it just sort of slid down. I mean, it was a steep embankment all the way down. And I finally got my breath, and I think, I don't think I overturned. I think I'm still intact. The reality took a while to soak in for me. And then I thought, how am I going to get out of here? And I put it in four-wheel drive, and lo and behold, it crawled right out. Now, that's nothing like getting vomited out of a fish. I got vomited out of a ditch, but not out of a fish. I wonder what, as Jonah stood there, this picture, he stands there, has all this vomit dripping off of him, and he said, hey, I'm alive. What do you think he did? From all indications, he said, I will go to Nineveh. I will. I will. I will. His song would have probably been, I have decided to follow Jesus. And I want us to do that right now. I'd just like for you to stand up before we leave. Stand up, and we're going to do it a cappella without any music instruments. And then Luke will lead us with instruments in just a moment. But I want us to start right now. And I'd like for it to be your prayer. I'd like for you to just bow your head, close your eyes. You've heard the song enough. I don't think you'll need the words. Without any instruments, I want us just to do it as our prayer. I have decided to follow Jesus. I'm in a pit. I've been dumped on by somebody else. I have the opportunity to give grace to somebody else, and I've not done it. I've never crossed that line of faith to really commit myself to follow Jesus. I keep thinking I do it on my own. Whatever it is that God's kind of tugging at your heart right now, you're going to say, I've decided to follow Jesus. Now, a cappella, Luke, just lead us. Let this be our prayer. Sing it out now.